rabbi sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, to Ready Freaking Out Alive again. It's October 30th, 2016. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, with Ryan Gable. Welcome back to the BBS Radio Network. We're here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 10 or 11 p.m. at Greenwich Mean Time to all of our loyal insomniac listeners over in England. Today, evil has an address, cult ritual crimes and how we stop them. We're going to use this show as a kickoff to a series of programs in November, including one with Sandra Fecht, counselor of Satanic Ritual Crime Survivors. And we felt in order to do that, and to do it fairly, we had to give some background into the nature of the crime, how it affects us all today. So we're going to do that. We're going to not only look at the crime, but what we can do about it. We've had a whole number of recent emails from listeners and calls of people who want to get into the nuts and bolts of how we set up these common law courts, how people are taking action in their own communities. And so we're going to also have that as a focus. Welcome, Ryan. It's good to have you back.
It's good to be here, Kevin. How are you doing this evening?
It's great. It's good to be live instead of a pre-recorded show like we did last time. So it's always good to be live.
Yeah, it always is. The energy flows a lot better.
I wanted to kick off, Ryan, with a couple of news items. And the first one being, as we know, we've been reporting on the different prison strikes going on across America. And I did a little bit of background research. First of all, for people who don't know who are tuning in for the first time, this has been reported thoroughly. We cover it on our tribunal website, itccs.org, and murderbydecree.com. But one of the things recently in the news, the reason behind these prison strikes is the massive use of, you know, a lot of prisoners across the world as cheap and slave labor. Now, people know about the situation in America. As a matter of fact, a thing in the news recently, one of the leaders of the strike, Robert Earl Council, he's a black man and an Alabama inmate who's led the strike. They've got him in solitary right as we speak at the Kilby Correctional Center in Alabama. Now, he was about to meet with an advocate with the Southern Poverty Law Center, and before he could, they stuck him away in solitary because he's been one of the spokespeople of this massive strike against not only, you know, slave labor conditions, but to try to get the 13th Amendment tossed out, which allows legal slavery in America under the Constitution. So I did some background reading, Ryan, and I know you'd probably want to comment on this. We know about the largest private prison corporation in America. It's called Corrections Corporation of America. It runs 65 prisons, got an annual revenue of almost $2 billion. But what Canadian and English listeners don't know is that an even larger corporation is running prisons in Canada and Britain. It's called Sodexo. And believe it or not, Sodexo, which has revenue actually five times bigger than the Corrections Corporation of America, Sodexo is actually began as a food processing company in France. And now they're running all these prisons that provide food for the U.S. Marine Corps, for military all over the world, and they're really into private prisons. Well, they also are very connected to, guess who, Cargill Corporation, the largest private company in America. And if you remember on our previous shows, we've talked about the links between Cargill and child sacrificial rituals, child trafficking in America, the very cult ritual crimes we're going to talk about today. So there is that whole thing, and I wanted to throw that out there, you know, for your comments and how we're going to tie that in today to our topics.
Well, first of all, I have to reminisce about the fact that I asked you that question relating to Cargill several months ago on a radio show that we did, my radio show, The Secret Teachings. And I remember I asked you about the connection between food processing companies and cult-type rituals and the sick lengths that some of these people go to, the possibility that, and this did happen in the 1920s and 30s, it was a byproduct of industry, there weren't safety regulations, and people, there's actually been books written on this, people would accidentally fall into these big vats, and they'd get ground up with the meat, and then the meat would be sold, and that was sort of a byproduct of the meat industry. I had thought and speculated that perhaps some of the bodies of these children or teenagers or adults were also used in the processing of this food, although it was kept extremely hush-hush and very secret at some of these companies. So it's interesting that you look at companies like Cargill, for example, and how they have a bit of a connection, as you're mentioning, to some of these cult-like rituals, and perhaps that's another area of research that might make you want to throw up. Otherwise, on the private prisons essentially are modern-day versions of slave plantations, and it's a legalized form of slavery, and especially when it pertains to the war on drugs around the world, but specifically in America, you have government agencies and organizations bringing drugs into the country so that they can make money outside of official government channels to run their operations in other countries or in America. And then that drug money that is made off the drugs that are brought into, the ghetto neighborhoods, brought into, like, for example, the Iran-Contra scandal, where drugs were flooded into South Central Los Angeles. And so you have the war on drugs that, on the surface, looks like it's fighting to keep people safe. It's fighting to keep people protected, fighting to keep people healthy. But what it really does is every time somebody's arrested, especially for a nonviolent drug offense, and specifically minorities and blacks are arrested at a much higher percentage than any other group, you put into a prison system for which is owned most of the time by another corporation, such as a big bank that also launders the drug money. Wells Fargo just got busted for this a few weeks back. Or a few months back, and they got busted again recently for a scam they were running on their customers. They laundered almost $500 billion for Mexican drug cartels. And so then you work in these private prisons for nothing. It's basically slave labor or pennies. And then the corporation that helps to launder the drug money or bring the drugs into the country makes a profit from putting you into that prison off of this phony war on drugs. And that's only a small piece of the puzzle, Kevin. But those are my initial thoughts.
Right. Well, thank you, Ryan. A little bit of more background on Cargill. If you go back to the ITCCS.org posting right after August 15th, 2014, you'll see that one of the Cargill corporate directors, Kerry Brick, was accused by survivors of being involved in some of the rituals of the Ninth Circle, the child sacrificial ritual, and one of those ceremonies that were actually stopped in Montreal, Canada, and one of the centers, of course, for the child sacrificial ritual. Is at the Marie-Rendement Cathedral in downtown Montreal. Well, Kerry Brick, Cargill corporate director, was also named by Americans as being involved in these rituals at the corporate headquarters in Wayzata, Minnesota, just outside Minneapolis. So, again, check back in previous postings at ITCCS.org. Also relevant to today is postings from in September and October of 2013, and 2014, two eyewitnesses, Anne-Marie van Billenberg and Toast Nienhaus, who were both survivors of the Ninth Circle ritual killings. They were raised within satanic families and also co-opted, without their knowing it, into these rituals. Their testimony is online. So that's important background for anyone who wants more info on that. But again, we're going to refer to some of that today in our discussion in more detail. Second item on the news, Ryan, I wanted to mention was we've had more and more reports coming out of the West Coast from Native people on the ground. I just spoke to two of them on Skype the other day. And the reports consist of the fact that some of the government-funded Native band councils on the coast, in the very areas where a lot of Native women and children have gone missing recently, they are actively disinterring grave sites, bones of their own people. Now, these bones include residential school children, those who have gone missing, elders, and people going back almost a century. Several examples were shared with us from central Vancouver Island and in northern British Columbia of these sites. Again, undoubtedly sites where bodies have been dumped recently, because according to the witnesses, this came directly in the wake of the Trudeau government's announcement of a so-called missing women inquiry. And on one of these sites on Vancouver Island, Band Council was announcing they were going to build a casino, and so they needed to do excavation. Well, they just happened to be excavating and digging up the remains, according to this one source, of 600 bodies were found in this one mass grave site. So again, this is the old practice. It isn't, well, sometimes, but not as much anymore. The RCMP that are digging up the graves, it's the Native-funded chiefs that are responsible for that. Any comments on that, Ryan?
Well, I recall doing some research on the Franciscan friar Junipero Serra that was canonized by the Pope when he came to America back in November of last year. And we were looking into the first organization, the first parishes that he ran and the natives were basically kept as slaves there. They'd be beat if they tried to run away, and most of them were executed if they didn't convert to Christianity. And I bring that up because when you say that there's hundreds and hundreds of bodies that are found, that might seem sensational to some people, but just as a more mainline version of history, if you look at somebody like Junipero Serra, the first church that he established on the West Coast in San Francisco, I believe it's called Mission Dolores, there are admittedly 300 bodies buried under the offices and the parking lot of that church. And that was actually, in, I believe it was in Time magazine that that was reported. You also had the Irish women's home where there were, I believe, 800 body parts or 800 full babies that were dismembered that were found in the sewer system of this Catholic-run Irish home for unwed mothers. This is well documented both in the mainstream and, of course, when we find in alternative versions of what is actually happening in current events and what goes back into history. This is all over the place. This is very common.
That's right. And 2 points on that. The Junipero Serra exposure. When Bergoglio, Pope Francis, was in America, his comment on Junipero Serra was, quote, "We are inspired by his zeal," unquote. So what the zeal he was referring to was that the zeal in wiping out non-Christian Indians, exactly what, it shows you these attitudes don't really change regardless of your political stripe as a pope.
Right, and he said that he's a man of his time. He was a man of his time.
Right.
Just basically acknowledging and admitting that the policy was genocide and that it continues today.
Well, exactly. And the second point on the cistern in Ireland that you mentioned, the Cardinal Sean Brady resigned the day after we exposed. I was on a Galway radio program, and we showed that Sean Brady himself was responsible in not only working in that area as a priest, so he's implicated having worked in that very home, but as the cardinal, he ordered a media ban and intimidation of journalists who began to look into that. And after we exposed that, literally he announced his resignation as top cleric in Ireland the next day. So it shows you, in terms of what we do, merely shining a light on these criminals often is enough to get them to resign, to at least bring more action to bear. So just for people to keep that in mind when we talk about things today, because it can get pretty overwhelming, a lot of this information. We don't want to leave people feeling powerless. Go ahead.
Well, another good example of that is I mentioned banks relating to the prison system and slave labor. The CEO of Wells Fargo, the big banking corporation, John Strumpf, he stepped down just a few days ago because there were 5,300 employees fired from Wells Fargo. And the argument from the mainstream media and from Wells Fargo was that all of these employees simultaneously, but not knowing that other people were doing it, decided to create fake bank accounts and siphon money out of the customers' bank accounts that were banking at the bank. Well, of course, that's a lie. All the managers should have either known about that and should be indicted, or they were ignorant and they chose to be ignorant and they allowed it to happen, or it was a policy within the bank. And so the CEO of the corporation stepped down once questions started to be asked. Just another perfect example. It was a policy. They knew about it. They were ripping people off knowingly. And that's a small act of criminality compared to the murdering of hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children.
Well, it reminds me of the quote from the lawyer Clarence Darrow earlier in the 20th century. He said, "A criminal is a person with predatory instincts without enough capital to form a corporation." That's a pretty good, accurate description. Now let's get on. I want to move on to our main topic today, and the whole thing of cult-ritual crimes. Now, there's a term often used, and I know Sandra Fecht, who will be on next week, does use it, satanic ritual abuse. In my opinion, this is somewhat of a narrow term in terms of describing the entire scope of what we're talking about. I prefer to use cult-ritual crimes, but really there's a lot of overlap. We're always often talking about the same thing. And let's get into a little bit about the definition of what it is first. I mean, we know the more dramatic aspects, but in your opinion, what is a cult ritual crime, Ryan?
I was going to ask you that because that's kind of phraseology that you hear used quite often. But when I think cult ritual crime, cult crimes sound somewhat more familiar, but cult ritual, I don't know, I would say off the top of my head it's some form of ritualistic, repetitive act of criminality that's carried out. And we think ritual, we tend to think because of church propaganda that it's a baby being sliced open on a black slab to Satan. That's not always what a ritual crime might be. It could simply be the disappearance of women, the murdering of women. We talked about that on a show a few weeks back. I don't know. Those are just my initial thoughts. What is exactly a CRC?
Well, you know, when you look, I know, again, for new listeners, and I know there's a bunch of you, I heard from some of you this week that you were going to turn in for the first time. And so I want to just draw your attention to Murder by Decree, The Crime of Genocide in Canada, one of our recent books through Amazon.com. You can acquire it, but it's also online, murderbydecree.com. Now, when you go to one of the appendices, we list in the very first appendix, number one, documented offenses committed in Indian residential schools in Canada. Now, when you look at these tortures, some of them being children made to run the gauntlet and be beaten by others, removing teeth, tonsils, and other organs without painkillers, forcing victims to eat soiled or regurgitated food, immersion in ice water, exposure to sub-zero conditions while naked. It goes on and on like this. Now, this was routine practice in Indian schools. That's why half the children never came back. Systematic torture. Now, you could say very easily this falls under the category of occult ritual crime, and yet it's operating under this general category of government-funded and legitimated religious education done by the churches, considered legal from the year 1891 to 1996, 105 years, and the very first year, half the children are dying off because of a practice of taking the healthy, putting them with the sick, and letting them all die. Tuberculosis, smallpox, etc. Now, all of that, in my opinion, falls under the practice of occult ritual crime because when you look into the nature of these different crimes, they all have common denominators. Not only are they secret societies, and they're intergenerational, the people within it are expected to stay quiet about it, and they are heavily protected. They have police, judicial, political protection. They involve religious rituals, often blood rituals, cannibalism, torture, that kind of thing. Now, somebody once said, you know, the Catholic Mass sounds a lot like a satanic ritual. I don't think it's simply a parallel. I think it's exactly the same process involved when you're being told that you're eating the literal body and blood of another person, whether it's Jesus Christ, an innocent child. It's really the same practice, and I think we have to break down these barriers that language creates around these different crimes.
Sure, and I think that there's so many different ways to view the consumption of blood and the eating of flesh. There's always a literal, profane viewpoint, and then there's an esoteric viewpoint as well. You do get people that have actually consumed blood. I think Queen Mary of Teck, the great-grandmother of Queen Elizabeth, I think Queen Victoria, I think Vlad the Impaler, who's related to Prince Charles. But then you also get an esoteric analysis of this going back into what we call the secret doctrine. And eating the body of Christ was an exemplification of the yearly turning of the wheel. We know this weekend is celebrated by many as Halloween, or within the church, All Hallows Mass, or All Souls Day on November 1st, or All Saints Day on November 1st, November 2nd is All Souls Day. And this would be a time when one of the final harvests of the year would be brought in, and the bread that would be made from the wheat would be consumed, and it would be believed symbolically that the soul, that the essence of the God, the sun God, would be in that bread, and therefore you ate the source of all life. You ate that God. So there's another way to look at it there. But then you also get the people that, of course, do it literally, whether that's because they are staunch religious believers, or they simply misinterpret what blood ritual and sacrifice is all about. There's just, the point is, for me, there's so many different ways to look at it. It's hard to really isolate and determine what somebody believes as opposed to what somebody like you or myself believe, because we can look at it from different points of view, but when we're looking at some of these crimes, these people are not doing it symbolically, they're doing it literally, and they may have other motivations for doing it literally, if that makes
well,
sense.
You know, there's this old Russian saying, everyone reacts differently to a tickle, but the same way to a hot burning iron. And I think it's the same thing here. You know, when we encounter evil, we all have an understanding of what it is. It's deliberate, it's destructive. The purpose is to subjugate, humiliate, and destroy human beings. And I think that is the common denominator in all this. You know, it's about domination. It's about feeding off the life force of another human being. And, you know, I think if we approach it from that point of view, rather than the different definitions and features, we see that, you know, this has really characterized society for many thousands of years. It's how elites rule. And one of the questions I want us to get into to some degree is, who is profiting? You know, it's clear from the, what we've documented, these are major institutions. I know, you know, recently I heard that there's a group that's been set up in Calgary. It in Canada, it's actually spread across the country now. It's and it's a really, it's a private vigilante group. It's called Creep Catchers. And they go around, they try to entrap people on the internet, set up meetings where they'll come and meet an underage kid, and then they grab them. And in fact, a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer in Surrey, British Columbia, this last week was nabbed that way when he was trying to trade in children. But the whole emphasis there is on finding individuals, and our focus is rather, what's the money behind it? Who are the institutions behind this, and who's really profiting and directing this whole thing? And, you know, I think we have to put our focus there if we're going to really stop these things.
Right. Otherwise, you end up with, when you say pedophile, or you say ritual crimes or child abuse, you tend to think of what you and I have discussed before, the so-called small fish. You might think of Jared Fogle from Subway, who was molesting young girls. You might think of Bill Cosby. You might even think of Donald Trump. But you don't really see the true evil behind the proverbial veil until you begin to realize that the people that are portrayed in both the mainstream and alternative media as being representative of this face of evil, of abusing women, of abusing children, of raping women, of raping children, that is minute compared to the crimes of the people that perpetuate these individuals as being solely responsible for that type of degradation in our society. The true people that are behind this, the true people that are responsible, are people that most of the time you've never heard their names before. It's just like when you see that Forbes wealthiest men and or women in the world, and Bill Gates is number one or number two. Most people know who Bill Gates is, but you don't really hear about the wealthy billionaires who have assets that more than quadruple the money that Bill Gates has. You don't hear about families like the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Schiffs, the Warburgs, etc.,
right,
etc. Those are names that are not out in the public arena.
Yeah, and just before we go into the break, one of the things I want to look at as well in the second half of the show, which is what people are doing about it and how we can arm people listening to,
yes,
do something about it. And I really want to focus on that because I know many of the listeners are out there. They've been saying to me, we need to join up with others. I feel isolated. I feel overwhelmed by this. How do we unite, and how do we take practical steps now? We don't need just the information. We've got to act on it. So I want to get into that in the second half. But leading into that is a very key issue, and that is language is used all the time to minimize these crimes, to soften the impact, and really a form of diversion and distraction. So one of the things I'm going to play now, it's a four-minute clip by George Carlin, the comedian, and he talks a little bit about that. I thought it was a good take on it. But just to remind folks, this will be an ongoing discussion, so please tune in next week as well to this show to carry this on. But let's take the break, listen to George Carlin, and then we'll be right back.
It's worse with every generation. For some reason, it just keeps getting worse. I'll give you an example of that. There's a condition in combat, most people know about it. It's when a fighting person's nervous system has been stressed to its absolute peak and maximum, can't take any more input. The nervous system has either snapped or is about to snap. In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language. Two syllables. Shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now. Takes a little longer to say. Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had the war in Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high by that time. And the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. Hey, we're up to eight syllables now. And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion sounds like something that might happen to your car. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, which has only been over for about 16 or 17 years. And thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that. I'll bet you that. Yeah. But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons is because we were using that soft language, that language that takes the life out of life. And it is a function of time. It does keep getting worse. Give you another example. Sometime during my life, toilet paper became bathroom tissue. I wasn't notified of this. No one asked me if I agreed with it. It just happened. Toilet paper became bathroom tissue. Sneakers became running shoes. False teeth became dental appliances. Medicine became medication. Information became directory assistance. The dump became the landfill. Car crashes became automobile accidents. Partly cloudy became partly sunny. Motels became motor lodges. House trailers became mobile homes. Used cars became previously owned transportation. Room service became guest room dining. And constipation became occasional irregularity. When I was a little kid, if I got sick, they wanted me to go to the hospital and see the doctor. Now they want me to go to a health maintenance organization or a wellness center to consult a healthcare delivery professional. Poor people used to live in slums. Now the economically disadvantaged occupy substandard housing in the inner cities. And they're broke. They're broke. They don't have a negative cash flow position. They're fucking broke. Because a lot of them were fired. You know, fired. Management wanted to curtail redundancies in the human resources.
And we're back. Thank you, George. You know,
that is classic. I love it.
Yeah, you know, it hits the problem right on the head, because genocide is not genocide in Canada. I like to say in Canada we have this guilt-free genocide system, because people don't even call it that. They always call it cultural genocide to soften it, except, oh, we were just not letting them speak their language. That's not too bad. I don't speak Irish anymore. It didn't hurt me. You know, that kind of attitude. But,
right.
You know, when we're talking about these ritual killings, you never hear the word torture used about Indian schools. You never hear murder, torture, you know, you have abuse. That word abuse was deliberately used in 1990 when the topic was first discussed in Parliament. They talked about residential school abuse, not crimes, because they couldn't have it under a criminal category under the law. People might go to jail. It was a tort offense, right, where you could apologize and go home. So I want to get into that, Brian. How, you know, in order to stop something, you have to reclaim the language. You have to reclaim your own mind and how you look at it. And that's one of the first barriers we get to. I mean, here's another example, the word pedophilia. It means friend of children, yet everybody uses it to describe a child rapist and killer. That's just one example. So let's discuss a little bit about language and how we can, by reclaiming language, start to arm people to gain the confidence to take on these crimes. What do you think?
Well, sure, I can talk about this subject for hours. I can tell you one thing for sure, especially being a bit younger and coming from the millennial generation. I've lived in a couple of cities in my life. I've always tended, for some reason, to live near college campuses. I live near the University of Central Florida, and now I live in the general area of Boise State University in Idaho in the United States. And the attitude at colleges for the younger generation is one that baffles me, even though I am from that generation. The attitude that if you say something that's offensive, that makes your free speech null and void. And in order for you to say something that might be offensive to me, but not the person next to me, but might be offensive to the person next to them, and therefore we always have to worry about everybody's feelings, then you actually have to go to a safe place zone, or you have to stand in a safe place box, where you have to stand in a free speech zone. So you can speak, but you can't hurt somebody's feelings with the words that you use. And so you're exactly right. And George Carlin, that was a fantastic clip, and he was very much ahead of what we perceive as time, because these are issues that we're now facing more directly. And I'll give you another really good example. If anybody around the world watched any of the presidential debates between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton did this often when she talked about gun control. She would mention, she actually said the word, she said, toddlers are getting a hold of guns. She said, our children are unsafe. And she kept hammering home those points, because when most people hear toddler or child, especially women, especially if they have children, there's that motherly instinct that takes over. Well, I want my child to be safe, even if it's subconscious. And therefore, whatever she's saying, even if it's subconscious type of language where she's not saying, let's remove guns from people's hands, it's that logical assumption that, well, if toddlers are getting a hold of guns, I'm a parent, I want my child to be safe, we might as well have some restriction on guns. I know that might be a silly example to some people, but that's the way that the language has been hijacked, and that prevents us from explaining and discussing pertinent issues.
Well, let's talk about, in terms of relating this to the topic today, that's cult ritual crimes. The topic is never even talked about in the media. One of the things Sandra Effect, well, undoubtedly the point she'll make next week, is something she's raised already, and that is the professionals in the counseling and psychological realms, they don't even acknowledge that these satanic ritual crimes go on. They call them something else.
Yeah.
And so the first step is to get people to acknowledge it's real, but you have to use the right language. You've got to call a spade a spade. Now, when somebody hears a story of a child being abducted, ritually killed, or when, as I described earlier, these ritual killings were going on routinely in the Indian schools, not one person's ever gone to trial for any of those crimes. There's a reason for that, because in the courts, you're not allowed to say certain things. There's a media ban. I don't know what it's like in America, but in Canada, there's a standard action by a judge when a child rapist is before him, and that's to put a media ban on it. So you can't know the name of the person or the gory details of what went on. And if you challenge that media ban, you can go to jail. If you name the crime, you're gaining power over the issue by naming it. That's the basic first step in an exorcism. You name the entity, it loses its power. And they don't let us name the most basic realities first. And this is, you know, the first step. So in terms of arming people, we've got to know it for what it is and use the right words, use the right language. And, you know, what I find, Ryan, is that people don't have the confidence to do that. They're always deferring to somebody else to give them the words to use. And that's something we have to, in our workshops, in our work together, we have to show people that you have to use your own language. In the healing circles, that's what we say to people. Don't look to us. Tell us in your own words what happened to you. It's valid. Your words, your own language is valid.
Well, there's a interesting example of that, because I saw a story, I believe it was from NBC News, but it was a study conducted on language and how people use language. And the scientists that conducted the study, I believe this was published at the beginning of the year 2016, back in February. And the scientists found that people that generally are obscene, and I don't mean somebody who just screams expletives, but somebody who speaks their mind, somebody who says what they are actually feeling, and somebody who does curse occasionally, and this probably is obvious to us, but somebody who does that is dramatically more honest than the person who tries to control and tries to alter language so everybody seems to be at least perceptually happy with the words that you say. And so with the example that you've given about how you're not even allowed to acknowledge the crime, that is exactly what is happening, not just in terms of cult-type ritual abuse, but even in terms of warfare. And I'll give you an example of this. In New York City a few years ago, there was a... I think it was through the New York State School Board, where they actually eliminated certain words that were not allowed to be used in a classroom. And some of the words that they eliminated was warfare. I believe they eliminated bombs, blood, terrorism. So you take out those words that would help people to explain crimes, or would maybe children grow up and they become protesters, whatever, they don't like war, whatever the case might be. and then you begin to program people with a language that fits into the agenda of those
right.
so-called socio or psychopaths. So that's just my thought, and it is, Kevin, it is absolutely a programming, but it's not one where you have to put a gun to somebody's head and say, hey, don't say that. It's one where people police themselves, and they put the gun to their own head, and they say, well, I can't say that. What are other people going to think?
Okay, now, in terms of getting this first step that we're talking about, getting people to name their own reality. This happened to me. This is, I know what's going on. We had an example of that a number of programs back. A survivor of cult ritual crimes in Ontario, Dave Staffen, who works with Sandra Fecht. Dave came on and he was describing in his own words, and he wrote a book about it, how it was like being raised in a cult ritual family, how he was taken out and used from age two on. And it was interesting. He said he was also taken to the Mohawk Indian School in Brantford. And there was a lot of overlap there in terms of what was happening to the Mohawk children by the Anglican Church. In fact, it was an Anglican church in Paris, Ontario. St. James Anglican Church, Paris, Ontario, 8 Burwell Street, where these crimes were going on in the basement. Now, the topic of the show today was evil has an address. And that's what I'm talking about in terms of when you name a reality, when you say, okay, we know that at 915 West Hastings Street in Vancouver, there's a Vancouver Club, and children are routinely taken in there, and especially from the local Indian reservations, and they're used by various elites and then sent away. Often they disappear after. Now, naming that name, naming the address, that's the first step. But then one of the obvious things people are faced with is, well, what do we do? How do we get the power to unite and stop these criminals when they often have police and political protection? And that's what
right,
I want to focus
that's,
on.
That's the aspect that seems, I think, so overwhelming, because that's when you start to think about that, what do I do, what do I do? Well, if you try to operate within the system, you get stonewalled. And I think that's always a key point to flag, is that you cannot operate within the system. You have to operate outside of the system.
Right, and that's been the focus of the last number of years in our work, establishing common law courts. Now, for people who are first-time listeners, and to remind others, if you go to our main tribunal website, itccs.org, in the right-hand column you'll see a common law training manual, and they give various steps as in what is the philosophy and the practice of common law. How can you as a citizen, a man and woman, set up common law courts that will actually investigate these crimes, issue summonses, bring out verdicts that can be acted on by other courts? And we know this has worked. We've done it already in terms of crimes in Canada and around the world. But it's getting people to break the ice. You know, it's the old saying, Ryan, of who's going to bell the cat? Who's going to take the first step on any given issue to do that? I find that once we can activate people to do that, a lot of others will follow. But it's becoming the tip of the spear. It's becoming the ones who are going to take that first step to allow the others to follow. And that's why in one of my books, The Truth Teller Shield, A Manual for Whistleblowers, we give you practical steps on how you do that. You seem to be alone at first, but there's things you can do to widen the circle, to get other people acting. And the main way you do that is by doing even a single act that's very public, very vocal. The way we did it in Vancouver, we started occupying downtown churches. And if you do something visible that's going to hurt the enemy in a big way, just by embarrassing them and threatening their money, which is all they really understand, and respond to,
would you say
if
it's
you do
best,
something like that, then you get a result. Sorry?
Oh, I was saying, would you say it's best to do it within a group of people, or are there things that we can do as individuals?
Well, I think, you know, the individual piece, Ryan, is standing on your own strength and understanding, finding your own words, but then it's imperative you find others like that, because, you know, the whole culture we live in is one where we're made to think that change happens through the great heroes, the ones who do it for us. We're raised to think and live vicariously through other people. We can't imagine that we have the power to do something for ourselves. And, you know, in a week or two working with people, I get this all the time. People say, well, I can't do it. Then I say to them, well, who's going to do it then? Oh, I don't know. Somebody knows better than I do. Somebody's willing to go up against City Hall. I don't know if I can. I find, you know, the thing that changes that in people is they've got to get a few whacks in the head themselves. They've got to go through bad times and lose something. They've got to pay a personal price, and then they realize, well, I don't have any options left. I've got to do something. Because if you have an option, you always find an excuse why you shouldn't do something, I find. And there, you know, there's that saying I have in my book, the saying from Carl von Clausewitz, only those under fire know that a war is raging. And that's very true, especially in this case.
Well, there's obviously, I guess you could call them support groups, or you can get information obviously online or through the books, but there are certain groups perhaps in cities across the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. and around the world that are already more active in their community, correct?
Well, you know, it depends on the issue. I mean, there's certain mainstream issues that are more acceptable, everybody knows about. Like, there's 5,000 people down in North Dakota this week at Standing Rock, and they're doing the traditional thing about a, quote, protest, which, as we've talked about, is really a way to transfer your energy en masse to the institutions of society, because you're saying, please give us something. And it's really an energy-depleting action. But, you know, other groups, you know, they tend to focus on these tactics. When you talk about any organization, they almost all are oriented that way, into getting something from somebody in authority. Whereas what we're talking about is radically different. We're talking about ignoring the institutions, taking back that authority, closing your bank account, reclaiming your land, reclaiming your children, setting up your own community police force to stop the criminals when they act. It's a matter of the doing now, though, because we know in theory what needs to be done. It's a matter of training people and taking the actions so these things will happen.
That's exactly right. And I think the first thing you have to do before you can take action, before you can get involved in any form of community or local activities, is you do have to, and this relates to language, you have to, in some way, shape, or form, free your mind from the constraints of how modern society works, in the sense of there's always that question. It's like when you walk across the street and there's no cars coming, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, let's say, there's no cars coming, and you stop and you wait at the stoplight area there because it's illegal to cross the street unless the stoplight is red and there's a little guy who's white that says walk. And people have that same type of issue in dealing with these types of crimes, knowing that churches and governments, et cetera, are involved. And that is, are we allowed to do this? Are we even allowed to protest? Are we allowed to ask questions? Are we allowed to put people that are in positions of power in prison? Is that even possible? We ask too many of those questions. We just need to do it. Just because something's legal or illegal does not make it incorrect or correct.
Well, the best education is your own experience. That experience never lies. And, you know, that saying, your best teacher is your last mistake, that's very true. We have to learn from those experiences and not defer to somebody else who somehow knows better than we do. That's the purpose. And in the 5 minutes left to us, I just want to say that when, you know, in future programs, we want to get more into the nuts and bolts. And one of the ways we'll do that is to go over some of the aspects of this manual for whistleblowers, because there's a lot of good advice in there about what people can do in response. You know, because we start as individuals, we start facing this on our own, but then we have to learn how to link up with others. But this Truth Teller Shield is aimed at individuals, saying, here's how to avoid naivety, here's how to think real as a realist in these situations, you know, how to you know, act on that basis. So we're going to do that, just so listeners know, because I know a number of you have requested this. We will be holding online workshops as part of these shows at least once a month. One of the shows every month will be devoted simply to be an online workshop and going over the questions you all have. And if you want to put forward some of these questions to us, just write to us, Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata@gmail.com. And we're going to give you some notice as to the things we'll be talking about on the air in response to these issues. Now, this program is also as used as a way to organize people, meet and listen to the show, and then meet afterwards to talk about how you can apply these ideas in your neighborhood. We have people all across the world, really, but in places like Vancouver, Ottawa, Toronto, people getting together to work on different issues, child trafficking, confronting local court corruption, that kind of thing. Those are often big issues that we hear about all the time. So we're going to be doing that in the weeks ahead. And again, to remind you, next Sunday, November 6th, set your clocks back. It's we're going back to standard time. So the clocks go back next Sunday. And at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, we'll have Sandra Fecht with us, the counselor who has a whole method of helping people deal with their own history of cult ritual torture and that kind of thing, and other forms of, I don't like to call it abuse, that's one of the words of the system, but you know what I mean, the trauma and tortures we go through. Ryan, any last words about this or any announcements you have?
No, nothing except that we all need to reclaim our minds, we need to reclaim our land, we need to reclaim our, well, I guess you could even say the love that we should have for each other, and we should realize that obviously things are not as they seem, and we should always have the respect for others that we have for ourselves, and we should have respect for ourselves. I think one of the things that the system itself does is it strips our ability to stand up to protest in any way, shape, or form, not just holding signs, by removing our will to live, by removing our sense of purpose. And that is done through these acts and programs of genocide that continue to this day. So we need to be, or at least in some way, we need to take back language, as you said, and we need to realize that every single one of us is important. It obviously doesn't matter what your race, color, creed, where you come from, or what you believe in. We can put a lot of that stuff to the side, most of it, and we can all realize that we're human beings and that we are here to have an experience, and we have that experience with other people. We should be learning, we should be growing, and we should not be throwing away what we have and what we perceive as life. So okay. That is my final closing comment. Thank you for having me on
Thank
the show,
you, Ryan.
Kevin.
And just to give folks another heads up, Sunday, November 20th, mark it in your calendar. Those are going to be days of action outside Roman Catholic and inside Roman Catholic, Anglican, and United churches. And we already have some ideas of what we're going to do on those days and beyond in response to their ongoing trafficking and torture of children and the covering up of their crimes against humanity. Sunday, November 20th. Also, follow our work, itccs.org, murderbydecree.com. A special hello going out to listeners in the north end of Winnipeg. We know that you're showing special interest at both Native and non-Native people, and there'll be more reports coming out of your campaign to expose child trafficking and criminality by the so-called Child and Family Services of Manitoba. And we're going to get into that again more. So next week, Sandra Fecht, Satanic Ritual Torture, How to Deal with It, how to move beyond it and expose it. And until next week, I especially urge you to follow our work at itccs.org for updates. Read our books, Murder by Decree, The Crime of Genocide in Canada, Unrelenting Between Sodom and Zion, and Truth Teller's Shield, all of which you can get through Amazon.com and also murderbydecree.com. I want to thank you all. We're going to go off by listening to Johnny Cash once again. And until next week, brothers and sisters, stay strong and stay clear. Thank you.
There ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. When I hear that trumpet sound, I'm gonna rise right out of the ground. Ain't no grave can hold my body down.